are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 4th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dave Zirin, I believe in Rio de Janeiro, for the opening of the Summer Olympics. I was trying to come up with the number. It's up there, but I don't remember. He's also author of Dance with the Devil, Brazil's hosting of the World Cup and Olympics. Also on the program, Stephen Breyer's deluded reasoning says the Supreme Court halting an order allowing a transgender student to use the bathroom. Meanwhile, big bumps for Clinton in the polls. Is it from the convention? Is it from the post-convention? Is it from the post-post-convention? Post-convention? Doesn't really matter. She's up nationally. She's up big in Pennsylvania, big in Michigan, big in New Hampshire. And Donald Trump's fall in summer continues. Planned intervention. The real question is, who's leaking all this stuff? The stories internally less relevant than the fact that we're hearing these stories in August, ladies and gentlemen. This is like late October stuff. The TPP looks like it's in trouble during the lame duck. And now people are asking, did Donald Trump marry an illegal immigrant?
Not good.
Not good. And as we get older, we have to let go of those things that we loved as a child. Why, Clint Eastwood? Why? Keep your mouth shut. Please. And the DOJ apparently raised objections regarding the Iran payment, but not because they didn't think the payment was appropriate, just that at one point someone might make an issue of how it looked. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, we got a lot of stuff to get to. But first, let me tell you something. One of the things that makes it easy for me, easier, I should say, when Nikki is out of town, is Blue Apron. Started getting this, I don't know. I've told you the story before. Benjamin gave it to us. John Benjamin gave it to us as a gift, just because apparently he's doing so well now that he feels like he can be, he can just throw his money around. I don't know what it was. He started using it. I mean, the guy owes me literally hundreds of dollars in back electrical bills from in the early 90s when we lived together. That's not the point. We loved it so much, we kept our subscription up. So twice a week, we get meals from Blue Apron. But it's not meals. It's ingredients for meals. But you get a menu. I mean, you get they give you a recipe, and they give you all the ingredients sort of pre-measured and whatnot. You got to cut it up. You got to prepare it. But it takes about anywhere from like 20 to 40 minutes max to make the best meal we've ever made up to that point. So each meal, you get my point, is that we make actually delicious meals. We cook them at home. And Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. So their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Beef is raised humanely. Chickens are free range. Pork is raised naturally. regenerative farming practices are used for produce. Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food deserts. Because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. It is amazing. For us, I think we get three meals for the 3.2 of us. And we just have exactly the right amount. So it's great. We don't have leftovers. We're not throwing anything away. Nothing sitting in the fridge rotting. It's perfect for us. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often than other families. And I have to say, last week, Myla got very involved in making some type of like tomato, corn salad. And it was delicious. And she gets excited about it when we're eating her food. And this is all for less than $10 a meal. So you can order Chinese food for the four of us, and it's more expensive than actually getting a great home-cooked meal. Blue Apron knows when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. It's true. Here are some of the meals available in August. Spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad. Summer vegetable and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplants, shishito peppers, and corn. Chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. And it tastes as good as it sounds, folks. Check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. It's true. Folks, I can't keep up with the amount of just like Trump stories that are just cascading. I took time last night to watch the Libertarian town hall. What a joke. What a joke, and not even a funny joke. Just a joke that fell flat. Gary Johnson, and look, I guess I've met Gary Johnson. I mean, I've done a couple of panel shows with him in the past. Back in the day, he was on Rattigan. The guy's a very nice guy. He never struck me as the smartest of guys. And I will say this, I've never realized how evasive the guy is. Anderson Cooper was not exactly dogged in doing any follow-up questions. And there wasn't a single thing that distinguished Johnson, for the most part, as a libertarian. Like, he didn't get into any of it. It was all like attempting to argue about, about drug legalization, all well and good, saying they have a big tent. But when it came to things like LGBTQ rights, he apparently didn't realize that there is no federal statute, or he ignored that fact because he didn't want to say in front of that audience, no, I'm not in favor of a federal statute that would make it illegal to prevent someone from getting housing or keeping their job because they're gay. He won't articulate that. So yeah, I guess you could say he's clever enough to be evasive. But it was unbelievable. And 90% of the questions were like, do you guys think that you're going to appeal to Republicans? Do you like Donald Trump? Do you like Hillary Clinton? If they had spent 20 minutes talking about their favorite color, I feel like I would have learned more about his ideology. But I don't know. I mean, and that stuff won't come out if he gets into a debate, I can assure you. But who knows? I mean, I don't know. I was very disappointed. I mean, because that's the second one I've seen. And I don't know. Anderson Cooper just doesn't seem to be interested. Folks, did you know that there's a home burglary every 13 seconds? Most happen in broad daylight with a burglar ringing your doorbell to make sure you're away before breaking in. Ring video doorbell has been proven to stop burglaries before they happen by allowing you to see and speak to anyone approaching your door using your smartphone. Now Ring is using their advanced motion detection technology to protect your entire property with the Ring security kit. I gotta say, I'm sort of obsessive about this stuff. The kit includes a Ring video doorbell for the front door and a Ring stick-up cam, the wireless weatherproof HD camera to keep an eye on other parts of your property. And they have an attachment, so you can make it solar. That's what's huge about that. Ring video doorbell and stick-up cam both install in minutes, and working together, they provide 24/7 monitoring of your entire home, whether you're in the living room or thousands of miles away. And you can do this, I don't know, I mean, if you want to do this for your kids who are living distance, just because you want to spy on them, or because you want to make sure that they're safe. I mean, for me, honestly, I spend hours looking at this thing. I just do. I find it calming. It's better than TV. If you want to check out, make sure one of your contributors is not bringing women into the studio off hours. Very effective. For a limited time, my listeners get $50 off the Ring security kit. It's the lowest price anywhere. Go to ring.com/majority. That's Ring, ring.com/majority now. Join the hundreds of thousands who protect their home with Ring. Go to ring.com/majority for $50 off. That's ring.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the great Dave Zirin.
Managed it 12-1. So far, I admit.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program. He is the host of the Edge of Sports podcast and radio show. You can find him at edgeofsports.com. Author of like a half a dozen books. Welcome to the Terror Dome. What's My Name, Fool? And Brazil's Dance with the Devil, of course, was his most or I don't even know if that was his most recent. Was that your most recent, Dave?
Yes, sir. New edition just out in time for the Olympics.
Dave Zirin, of course, author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil, which covered Brazil's, I guess, both seeking and receiving or being awarded the hosting duties of both the World Cup and the Olympics. Was this unprecedented to have these two events so hosted at the same country back to back?
Yeah, the only other time it's happened was the United States in 1994 hosted the World Cup and then 1996 hosted the Olympics. But that's totally apples and oranges because Atlanta was the host city for the 96 games, and Atlanta was not a World Cup site. In Brazil, Rio was the epicenter of the World Cup. It's where the finals were played and some of the most important matches. And, of course, now the Olympics are in the city of Rio. So it's never happened where one city was the epicenter of both events. And when you tack on top of that the fact that we live in a post-9/11 world where the demands made on a host city are so different than even 20 years ago. I mean, no country has ever faced this kind of sports mega event stress.
When we talk about this and you know, I don't want to paint this with too much of a broad brush, but is the story about Brazil or is the story about these massive global sporting events as and the story that they tell and the story that they sort of parallel about development in this era of our world?
I got to tell you, Sam, that is the most important question and it is the most least asked question. So I just want to thank you for answering it, because there are so many stories about Brazil's dysfunction right now, because there's a political crisis independent of the Olympics, an economic crisis independent of the Olympics. And, you know, hosting the games always leads to snafus. And we live in a social media climate where everything is, you know, taken a picture of and passed around the world immediately. For example, two of the bigger Olympic stories of the last 24 hours are at the Central Stadium where they're having the opening ceremonies. No one could find the keys to open up the gates to set up. And so there's a photo going around of a guy with a massive bolt cutter just to get everybody in the stadium. And then there's another story about a gentleman who was running with the Olympic torch. He dropped trow. He was wearing a leopard thong and he had an anti-impeachment message written on his butt cheeks. And, you know, you get stories like that. And
wasn't there like a jaguar too? Like they had to shoot a jaguar or something?
They shot Juma the Jaguar, who was the Olympic mascot. That's another one, because they didn't give Juma sufficient tranquilizers is what they said. And it was a security concern. So a police officer shot him in the head, by the way, in front of tons of children who had gathered to see him. And another story is 28 of the best skydivers in the world jumped from a plane to form the Olympic rings, and two of them got their parachutes caught and fell to their deaths. I mean, stories like this, I mean, Tom Wolfe wouldn't use stories like these because he would think they were too ham-handed. And yet these are happening. And yet when you have this pileup of stories, it is so easy to turn this into a narrative about Brazil's dysfunction or the idea of, oh, well, we shouldn't have Olympics in the global South. And I think what that ignores is exactly what you raised, that there's a fundamental problem with how the Olympics, how the World Cup, those two in particular, are actually organized, that takes every country's weak points and puts incredible amounts of pressure on them. And that's true whether you're talking about Brazil, the United States, China, you name it, it will exacerbate your country's worst qualities.
I mean, there's something about these events, the intersection here, that is mutually revealing, right? I mean, because like you say, it exacerbates the weaknesses that exist in that society. And then it also reflects back upon the sort of the predatory nature of these endeavors.
Yeah. And we'll take that in the exact order you laid them out. Like if we were talking about like what's the worst aspect of Atlanta in 1996? Well, it was a city that it has a lot of racism in the criminal justice system. I mean, the joke in Atlanta was that the only thing that was built on time and under budget was the new prison that they built.
Right.
And the ACLU found out that the police were pre-writing up arrest notices for young black men, like pre-writing them, and then going out and finding young black men to arrest in advance of the Olympics. And, of course, there were protests outside led by former civil rights leaders because of displacement while they were having this tribute to Martin Luther King done with like, you know, flaming sparklers happening in front of Bill Clinton on the field itself with Muhammad Ali lighting the flame. You know, what's China's biggest problem? Obviously, it's totalitarianism. 1.5 million people displaced in China to make way for the Olympics. Tons of political prisoners collected before the Olympics. And of course, what's the main problem in Brazil? Well, it's corruption, and it's a society run particularly by an oligarchy that's largely rooted in the construction and real estate trade. Now, what does the Olympics bring? Massive expenditures in real estate and construction. And that has meant an explosion of corruption scandals that have gone along with the Olympics as well. And I could, there's obviously more to say about what's been exacerbated in Rio by these games. But I think the word predatory, I believe that's the word you use. I think that's predatory. I think that's the right word in this case, because the predations of the International Olympic Committee, the demands of the International Olympic Committee are always what wins in the end. So there were dreams by Brazil when the economy was sky high and they won these games that the Olympics would be used to create development that would reduce economic inequality. The opposite has been the case. And one of the reasons why that is that the country's been in economic crisis, and yet the IOC, you know, like Ray Liotta and Goodfellas, they always have to get paid.
Let's go back to that, because the psychology behind what was happening in Brazil, based on the overconfidence that, like, right, you know, the oil prices were being what they were, was going to last forever. And this idea, like, this is our opportunity. Because from what I've read, there is a sense of, there's a little bit of a sense of an insecurity that Brazil is not in the, you know, is part of the, I guess, BRIC, right? I mean, it's not in the first, it's not quite there yet. And that this was, by having these two world-class sporting events, I guess, would propel them into another stratosphere. And I don't know. It sort of feels like there's so many analogies that come to mind when you think about, you know, small businesses that overextend themselves
Icarus.
Yeah, I mean, it goes on and on.
That's the case here. You go back, you know, the thing about it, though, going back, is that one can understand why they had that irrational exuberance, because the entire world had that irrational exuberance. Right. Some of this is about understanding the disaster that was the Bush administration in the 2000s in the United States, spending several trillion dollars on war in Iraq. I mean, one of the things that meant was that international commodities investors in the 2000s literally just parked their money in the Brazilian stock market. And when you couple that with the discoveries of oil and the commodities boom and being a major exporter to China, which was having its own absolutely, you know, volcanic economic growth, it meant that Brazil was like, this is our moment. And this kind of rhetoric was used all the time about how this is going to catapult us into the first league of nations. This could even, excuse me, get us a spot on the UN Security Council. And what's so crazy looking back on it is you see all of this excitement, and the one word that you never really see is sports. So right. It's never about sports. It was about patriotism. It was about power. It was about prestige, but not sports. And I think that's when you get in a lot of trouble, because that's what the games have become. They've become a form of development. They've become a form of a much deeper form of propaganda and costlier form of propaganda, really, than they've been in the past. And they've reached this point where all you're really getting out of it is debt displacement and the militarization of public space.
That's fascinating. And I think at the time, like, Lula said something to the effect of, like, God is Brazilian. I mean, it was that it was that big of a deal. I mean, when you describe the games like that, Godwin's law excused for a moment, but I immediately have a sense of, like, what the 36 games meant to Hitler. And, you know, forgive me, but that's what that was, right? And was there did that maintain, or has that come back in sort of a more sort of commodified way? I mean, in some way, like, the games have become like everything else, it seems to me, in society, where it's completely commodified and financialized in many respects.
Yeah. Like, have you ever been in a position where there's an actual real life Nazi like David Duke, and you say, geez, look at that guy, he wants to be Hitler, and someone's like, duh, 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 Godwin's law. And you're like, well, wait a minute. Can I get an exception since he actually is?
We're talking about a neo-Nazi, right?
Yeah, doesn't that, like, allow for an exemption? I mean, I think when you talk about the Olympics, you need a massive exception of Godwin's law, because I don't think you can understand the modern Olympics without understanding the 36 Olympics in Berlin. And let's talk about why for a second. The 36 Olympics in Hitler's Germany, they were the first games ever that had the pageantry of the modern Olympics. Before that, the Olympics really was this kind of low-cost affair that was organized by aristocrats as a place to showcase the nobility of sport. I mean, it was very, very aristocratic in mindset. And that's not to say that winners weren't bathed with glory and that countries didn't find prestige, but it was a different kind of operation. 36 was the first Olympics where you had the people, the athletes actually march in a military style, representing themselves country by country. The 36 Olympics was the first one that had the running of the torch. All of this stuff was organized by Joseph Goebbels' department. And if you go back and track it, as historians have done, they particularly did their torch runs through the parts of Europe that Hitler went to conquer immediately into the late 1930s. Mm. So it's this very direct, like think like Austria, Poland. I mean, this is where they went. And so that's 36. 1940, you have no Olympics because of World War II. 1944, you have no Olympics because of World War II. 1948, there's no more Germany. It's been split in two, and yet all of the pageantry that Goebbels thought of for the 36 games became a fastened part of the Olympics, not the least of which because the person who ran the Olympics, Avery Brundage, and then his successor, Juan Antonio Samaranch, were both dedicated fascists. Samaranch was a youth fighter for Franco in the 1930s, and he ran the Olympics through the 90s.
Wow.
So think about that for a second. I mean, so this isn't like Godwin's law stuff. This is like people said, you know, fascism was really good at putting on these Olympics. Let's make sure we keep some of that stuff. But of course, when you want to put on a production like that, you also got to make sure that, you know, like Mussolini, you make the trains run on time. And if everything has to run on time and be perfect, it means little things like dissent or somebody's homes. All of that is just collateral damage.
So there's a certain inevitability if you're going to involve yourself in an endeavor like that. I mean, there's two thoughts that come to mind. One is that at one point it seems to me. I mean, I just feel this as a kid. You know, being I guess I don't know 14. 13 when Mike Urizioni and I don't know, for some reason it seemed very Boston to me when when USA won the gold medal in the hockey, but it became sort of like this, I don't know, this outlet for the Cold War in some way, right? It was like and became very, very, I don't know, patriotic is the right word, but East versus West. It became obviously huge in those years of the Cold War.
And can I tell you please, real quick, Sam, if you go back and read the Sports Illustrated article, and their whole archives are online about the 1980 victory, They quote tons of people who directly reference the Vietnam War and say, I feel like it's okay now to be proud to be American again. The last time I saw people with flags, other people were spitting at them or trying to tear them out of their hands. Now we're all waving them proud to be part of America.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I was really fully conscious of that, but that makes total sense. That was the first big display, I guess, of sort of unified. Everybody could buy into that because it was supposedly harmless. I mean, in some ways, the story of the World Cup and the Olympics are somewhat interchangeable, but. Within the context of Rio, because of how dispersed the World Cup is, it's different, isn't it? Or I should say Brazil.
Yeah, it's a little different. Certainly, the difference between staging something nationally and staging something just in a city. But the World Cup was so centered on Rio, and I was there in Rio for the 2014 World Cup. It's like you couldn't even gather with 10 or 15 people without being surrounded by military police and being surrounded by 10 or 15 reporters who wanted to see some sort of confrontation. I mean, the mood was really tense. And I got to tell you this, I'm heading to Rio in a couple of days. I have colleagues who are already there. And one colleague, she got in touch with me, and I found this fascinating, that she got off the plane at the airport, and there was a group of striking metro workers inside the airport having a demonstration and handing out leaflets. And there was a guy with a machine gun from military police maybe 10 yards away, not doing anything. And I've been thinking about that a lot, because when I was there for the World Cup, there is no way you could even do that on the street, let alone inside an airport. And the only conclusion I can draw from this is that the situation on the ground must be so tense that they're going to allow a little more space for steam to be released so there aren't actual, you know, riots. Taking place, because when you have economic contraction this deep, when you have a health and education crisis so severe, a food crisis that's severe, you better make sure that there's some space open for dissent, especially when the world's media is focused on your city.
Isn't there also, I would imagine, there's also a tremendous amount of cynicism. I mean, it's shocking. We haven't even gotten to this in and of itself would be dramatic enough. But today is the day when the Brazilian Senate committee votes on whether or not to recommend, impeaching or removing Rousseff from office.
Yeah. Crazy schedule. I have no proof of this, but it certainly seemed like they were timing this to happen, and then 6 months later, right amidst the Olympics, go through the process. I think the thought was that the new president, Michel Temer, who is an opposition party guy who was brought into the cabinet, there was thought that he would restore financial confidence, and this Olympics could be kind of a kabuki theater for his own rise to power. But he's so unpopular now that there's talk that he might not even show up to the Olympics for fear of the optics of getting booed and whatnot. It's already been ruled by a judge that he can't run for re-election because he's so corrupt. There's a ton of drama happening independently of the Olympics. And there are a lot of people who are going to try to use the Olympics to make it real and make it live. But there's also a great, great deal of cynicism about politics and about there being any political party in Brazil that could represent people's interests. And in a weird way, I got to tell you, I'm a little bit heartened by the cynicism, because the alternative would be that the country moves to the right, because and that's not quite happening yet. But there needs to be some sort of social democratic reconstitution, because that's what people want. In every poll, that's what people want. They want a leadership that takes on neoliberalism, that takes on inequality, that tries to speak to those issues, that takes on police violence. And the right there's no Trump-like figure, but there is, like, they are offering like military dictatorship as a solution, and certainly people would reject that. But it's a dire situation at the moment.
Moving away from Brazil, is it possible for the Olympics to come to town and be a force for good? I mean, when or let me just stay with Brazil for a moment. Like, what do you anticipate in 2 weeks from now? Like, what is it? Is it just sort of, are things just sort of bombed out? I mean, what, like, what's left in the wake of this? I mean, part of it, you know, I guess it's encouraging that you're, you know, people are striking, but I mean, does this create, is it just people are exhausted and cynical? I mean, this has been like a two or three, I mean, really since 2008, right? Like it just a sort of a cascading, of not great things.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's like, I hear people in this country exhausted by like, oh my God, I can't believe we have 90 some odd days left of this election. Like it would be like if this Clinton Trump election was going on for 5 years.
Everybody in this office just sort of like had an issue with themselves. Not good.
Every day another crappy story. Every day something to make you wonder: has everybody gone mad? You know, and it's every day just the exhaustion that can breed. If you feel like there's no real popular response or way to make it worth something, or where if you think you're going to come out better on the other end. So I have no idea. I mean, I think the first step is seeing if these Olympics can be pulled off without utter catastrophe. And I think that for these Olympics, and you know, I'll see it when I'm down there, but what we're going to be talking about here is either they're going to clear a very low bar or something catastrophic is going to happen. And there's really no middle ground there. It's not going to be great. If the games pull off, you know, people will tend to then ignore what's happening at the margins, because let's face it, this is a made-for-TV operation. It's not a, you know, people don't really care about what happens in Rio.
Right.
But for the people who are left behind, they're going to be presented with a bill. And I think that, you know, strikes, I think demonstrations, I think all of these things are on the table, because when people are like, okay, we now have to pay for this $12 to $20 billion Olympics while, you know, there's not money to combat Zika or decent schools, I mean, that will burn people.
And we haven't even mentioned the Zika virus, which, of course, you know, prevented or was cited by at least some athletes as to why they weren't going to go.
Yeah, I say this about Zika. One thing folks got to realize is that it's winter in Rio. It's not mosquito season. It's a bit overblown. Obviously, if you're somebody who is pregnant or is thinking about getting pregnant or in a relationship with someone who you want to have be pregnant, I mean, because it is sexually transmitted as well, it is a significant worry. But if you're not in any of those categories, I mean, this is really small grade stuff. And it's been blown up to be so huge because, I mean, obviously, of course, because of birth defect fears. And I think that hits people on a very gut level when you see the pictures of suffering babies. But when we're talking about like, you know, millionaire golfers who say, I won't go to Rio because I'm worried about Zika, I mean, it's hard not to raise a little eyebrow.
Is it possible for the Olympics to come to town and not have this effect? I mean, is it, are we just past it? Like this is, because there's a quality here that also sort of reminds me of stuff that you have written and talked about for years about, you know, the publicly financed stadiums. And I don't know, it reminds me of like, there's a huge mall project in New Jersey where like billions of dollars just keep getting sunk into, and it hasn't been built in like 12 years, and they keep getting tax breaks and they keep getting subsidies. And I don't know, it's like, I can't remember what the name of it was, like the Great America Mall or something. I don't know, something like that. But
yeah,
is it possible though? Because I know that I read a piece that you wrote about to LA, basically saying like, you guys better pass.
Be very afraid.
Yeah. I mean, is there a place anywhere? Is there a generic place that the Olympics could actually work? Or is it by the fact that there are, I mean, it seems to me like a lot of this is driven by there are people who stand to gain a lot of money in these various cities who by virtue of the fact that they stand to gain a lot of money also indicates that they've already established a certain amount of political power in those cities. So they're driving these committees to get the Olympics to come to whatever city it is. And I imagine, you know, it's a different dynamic depending on, you know, the nature of the country. And so they want it to come. It's going to be at other people's expense. It's going to be privatizing the gains for themselves, socializing the losses. And the Olympic Committee sort of feeds on that and pits these different cities or states or countries against each other because there are interested parties who know they're going to make money, and they're just basically offloading the cost to everybody else.
Yeah.
Is there a way that this doesn't happen, or is this inevitable? Is this going to keep getting worse? Like, you know, we saw what happened in Sochi, which was like not a place, but still was incredibly exploited, it seems to me.
Look, yeah, that's a huge question. I mean, first and foremost, what we're really asking is, can there be an international sporting event that allows us to highlight interesting sports that we don't normally consume, that can create new heroes and sheroes who otherwise would never see the light of day in our very monochromatic, white flour, high-carb diet of sports that we usually get? And is it possible to have it exist in a way that leaves as small a footprint as possible? And the way I would answer that question is not under the leadership of the International Olympic Committee. I think it is so baked into the cake of the IOC to organize the Olympics in this way that if we want these kinds of games, it would take new leadership, new organization, new oversight, new checks and balances to be able to do it better. And it would take having the sense, and a lot of people have said this over the recent years, especially post 9/11, that you should have the Olympics in this one place, or maybe a rotating series of two or three places the way they do the Super Bowl. And that way you don't get these quote-unquote white elephants, these stadiums that then rot, or like in Athens, Greece, turn into homeless shelters and squatter settlements. They can actually be places that are continually refurbished because they'll have a use value beyond the Olympics. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never woken up and said, this is a lovely morning for a luge. You know, so most of these things aren't really used after they're done. So is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. Under its current leadership, it's kind of like – it really is kind of like ordering a cake and saying, this is delicious, but I wish you could have – you know, hold the sugar, basically.
Right.
You can't do it.
So lastly, let me ask you this, because I know you have children around my daughter's age. My son's too young to fully grasp the Olympics, but but, you know, for my 11-year-old daughter who sees the poster for the Olympics, I mean, yesterday we were going around. She's like, oh, my God, the Olympics start this week. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, they're in Brazil. It's a tough situation down there. I mean, how do you – and I know I've asked you this question in the context of other sports, whether it's like, you know, football or whatnot. But, I mean, how do you – how do you approach these games? Like, do you enjoy them? Do you watch them? What do you tell your kids? Like, how do you maneuver in that area?
Well, starting point is this. As we were talking, I got a little beep on my Twitter here, and I saw that that Majority Report put out the show by saying, what we learned, you learn things from Edge of Sports, like the Olympics actually are fascist. I would say that the way the International Olympic Committee organizes the Olympics has serious, serious ties to fascism, to the legacy of Juan Samaranch, who was a fascist, Avery Brundage, who was a fascist sympathizer, and the 36 Olympics. But the sports themselves are beautiful. And if they weren't beautiful, we wouldn't keep going back to them. So my whole thing is, like, you got to watch it as a conscious sports fan. You know, don't watch it unconsciously. Be aware of the cost that's being paid. Be aware if the Olympics try to come to your town, like the brave people in Boston, Krakow, and Oslo, all of whom organized to keep the Olympics out. That's, I think, the key question. It's not about denying ourselves the pleasure and joy of these sports any more than I think we should deny ourselves art or architecture or food, even if it was produced in a way that was fundamentally inhumane. That's one thing to be part of a movement. It's another thing to make individual choices on these questions, which at the end of the day, you know, might make an individual feel better morally, but don't do a lot to change the underlying structural problems.
Really well said. And Michael will correct that tweet right now.
Oh, no, I thought love that tweet was sharp. I mean, I would click on that.
That's what he was thinking, too, I think. But, Dave, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And it's always I mean, it, to a large extent, we should consume sports in the same way we consume everything with a level of consciousness and awareness as to what the impact is around it, rather than just sort of blindly. And I think that was really well said. I appreciate it, buddy.
No, thank you so much. Hopefully we can talk after the games.
Yeah, it would be great to touch. All right, touch base. Thanks, Dave Zirin, edgeofsports.com. And, of course, check out his book, Dance with the Devil. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Fascinating stuff. There's nobody who does what he does. I mean, I imagine there might be. But I don't know them. I mean, who has been consistently, like, he has opened up like an entire genre, it seems to me, of sports writing that I think there are others now who have sort of have come to it on some level. But to make us aware of, you know, where our sports come from, really, is what that's about. Fascinating stuff. Folks, you can become a member of the Majority Report very simply by simply going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is pennies a day. It is your support that makes this show possible. We put out, oh my gosh, we've put out, how many shows have we done? Almost 1,500 shows in the past 5 years. In November, I guess it will be 5 years, 15, and we'll be past 1,500 shows. And members obviously get to go back and very easily search the archive and whatnot. And we're constantly trying to make improvements. People for a long time, like, why would you make an app for your show with absolutely no way of monetizing it? And the best answer I could come up with is that I'm not a good businessman. But part of it is that's the best answer. But
it's true.
But it's true. But a part of it is that I feel like it is a tremendous privilege for me to have the opportunity to interview the people that I do. And I feel like it's also my obligation to try and amplify what these people have to say. And sometimes it's more political than other times. And for the most part, it's political. But just interesting ideas that I think deserve to be amplified and to get into the bloodstream. And so, you know, to have an app that makes it easier for people to listen to is one of the things we do. But, you know, we want to update the app. We want to make the website better. We want to perfect both the mechanism for delivery and accessing and help the show grow, and also the easier and more seamless that stuff is, the more we can spend time on content. So, but to do those type of things, we need your support, and to just do it on a basic on a daily basis, we need your support. So you can become a member if you enjoy the show, you listen to it with any type of regularity. You know, think about those reoccurring subscriptions you have to, I don't know, what do people have? I mean, everything now. How often you use that versus how often you use this show, then become a member. And you get extra content as a bonus. We give you more than double what we give for freebies. But, and that's insane. But nevertheless, it's your support that makes this show possible. Of course, if you drink coffee, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you want to use any of the discounts that we're getting from any of our sponsors, whether it was Blue Apron today or Ring, or any of the others that we've mentioned on the show, Casper and Harry's, just go to majority.fm and click on the support our sponsors. You'll get all the updated information there. Also, you know, Two Dope Boys, listen to a show produced by majority.fm, hosted, at least co-hosted, by Michael Brooks. People rave about that show. If you want something that's a little more cultural in its focus. But lastly, a Majority Report kickback.com. If you buy a craft from Amazon or jet.com, go there, click on the link, bookmark it, always buy your Jet or Amazon stuff from there, and we get a kickback. All right, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your calls. We will take your IMs. We've got sound of Trump just having, I don't know.
We need to rehash things.
Tomorrow, we're going to talk to Cliff. And I have a feeling Cliff and I are both just going to be like, I know. And I mean, why?
I have a solid feeling that that isn't going to happen and that you're both going to have a lot of words to say over each other.
Nailed
it's gonna last
it.
A long time.
Nailed it. Yeah, we're just gonna be flummoxed. Yeah.
Yeah. Just Sam dead
and
air.
Cliff. Yeah,
Sam
totally.
Cliff, dead air.
Yeah. I meant emotionally, we're gonna be that way. The mouths
are always emotionally
mouths,
flummoxed. There's
mouths,
nothing new there.
The mouths still continue to flap. All right, we gotta take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.